It's a presidential tradition. Go to some beloved local hash house, conspicuously eat something, and then watch your approval ratings rise or fall. You could argue that John Kerry lost his campaign in 2004 when he went to Philadelphia and ordered a cheesesteak with Swiss instead of Cheese Whiz. Food is how presidents show America that they're normal people. But inside the White House, food, and the people cooking it, have played different roles. That's according to Adrian Miller, a historian of African-American cooking. In his new book, The President's Kitchen Cabinet, he digs deep into the lives of Black presidential cooks, from the state dinners prepared by enslaved servants, to the meals a Black cook served the president while making her case for the Civil Rights Act, to today. Food in the White House offers a fascinating look at race and power in America. Adrian, so great to have you here.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So in your book, you know, we read about dozens of Black cooks in the White House, from the enslaved to the free and professional, and they play all these different roles. You write about them being babysitters and pitmasters and civil rights advisors and comfort food enablers, confidants, culinary artists, diet enforcers, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It's amazing you can find records of so many of these people, but I want to first ask you to tell us more about one person in particular.
Sure.
I'm fascinated to know about Hercules.
Right. So Hercules was one of the enslaved cooks for George Washington. And Washington acquires him when he's about 19 years old. He was a ferryman. And he transfers him to the Mount Vernon kitchen where he apprentices under the enslaved cook in that kitchen. And at some point, he takes over duties there. So when Washington ends up in Philadelphia, where the executive residence was while the White House was being built, there was a woman named Mrs. Reed, a white woman, who was the first cook at that residence, and he wasn't too happy with her cooking. So Washington brings Hercules up to Philadelphia and installs him as the cook there.
But Philadelphia was a place where slavery was quasi-legal or not really that legal, right? There was a law that you could only have enslaved people for like a certain period of time.
So there was the Gradual Abolition Act of 1780, which said if you were an enslaved person on Pennsylvania soil for longer than 6 months, you are automatically free. So what Washington did to get around that is right around the six-month deadline, he would pack up all the enslaved people, send them back to Mount Vernon, chill them out there for a few weeks, and then bring them back to start the clock all over again.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are all these stories you read about in the book where, like, Hercules was sort of a man about town, and he would walk around Philadelphia, and he dressed in this sort of dapper way. So
Washington gives him a lot of liberties. He's allowed to go to the opera. When his shift is over at night, he gets to dress up like a dandy almost and wear blue vests and suit coats and a golden cane and walk around town. So he was a known personality. I think one of the other cool things is he was allowed to sell leftovers out of the back of Washington's kitchen. And he made about $5,000 in, you know, current dollars selling his leftovers. So you know the brother had skills, real mad skills.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me because, like, I feel like when we think of enslaved people, you have a very particular image mm-hmm. of what that life was like. And I'm sure a lot of it is really accurate. But just the story of Hercules, I feel like kind of blows that up a little bit for me and just makes me feel like, oh, there's more to that.
Right. And he definitely breaks the mold. And he was a temperamental chef. There's the George Washington Park Custis, who was Washington's step-grandson, gives descriptions about all the people that worked for Hercules because he had a biracial staff. So he had enslaved people as well as white indentured servants working in his kitchen. He supervised them in the kitchen, but evidently he would yell and they would just fly at his direction. So I think he would feel a kinship with Gordon Ramsay, you know. But Hercules is a well-renowned chef. People write about him in their memoirs long after Washington is dead. And so we know that he was a great culinary artist of his time. So he had a tremendous reputation.
Yeah. And so, you know, you found all these stories, Hercules being a really notable one, but dozens and dozens of them. Were there any of the cooks that really stood out to you?
I would say in addition to Hercules and maybe James Hemings, who was one of Sally Hemings' older brothers who cooked for Thomas Jefferson, he was never a presidential cook. But the one that just stays with me is Zephyr Wright, who was the longtime family cook for Lyndon Johnson. And she started cooking for the Johnsons before Johnson enters Congress. And as he rises through the ranks in Congress, many attribute Zephyr's cooking to his establishing his reputation as a great host and a great entertainer. Because back in those days, members of Congress would actually invite other members of Congress over to dinner. That's how you ingratiated yourself and got to know people. And Zephyr Wright's famous Southern cooking was part of the the reputation that was built for the Johnsons.
Yeah.
And she actually becomes part of the family. When Johnson becomes president, she sits in the inauguration box with the family.
Wow.
And I don't know of another cook who's done that in presidential history.
Yeah. There's a story that you tell in the book, or just a line, when Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
He gives her the pen.
Yeah, so one of the things that people don't know is that Johnson, when he was lobbying for that legislation, that landmark legislation, he would often use Zephyr Wright's Jim Crow experiences to persuade members of Congress to support the bill. Because at that time, the family would drive back and forth from Texas to Washington, D.C., and Zephyr would go along with the family, and she could not go to the bathroom, and she couldn't go to the restaurants at the same time as the family. She suffered so many indignities that she said, I'm refused to take this trip any longer. So she would just stay in D.C. year-round.
Hmm.
And so by the time the bill gets passed, that's why Johnson makes this grand gesture to her and says, you deserve this as much as anyone.
But he said you deserve this, not just like you suffered enough.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, she's the kind of person that I assume when you wrote, many of these cooks played roles, including civil rights advisor. I assume she was one of the people you were referring to in that.
Yeah, but I would call her an unwitting civil rights advisor, because if you look at the oral histories that she has left behind, she kind of has this cat and mouse game with Johnson, because Johnson would come and say, well, you know, do black people really appreciate what I'm doing? And she'd kind of say, I don't know, I guess so. You know, she'd be a little coy and things like that. But she definitely gave Johnson, and I think this is the broader role of these cooks in the book, she gave him a window on black life that he may not have had otherwise.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was up to a president whether to open that window or not. Many chose to keep it closed, but I think our nation's better for the ones who actually took the time to talk to their cooks and get a sense of what was happening in for African Americans in our society.
Yeah. It suggests that there's such a power there, right?
Yeah.
When you have access to someone in those kind of intimate moments, and I imagine for a president too, like a president lives such an incredibly public life.
Right.
That I assume the moments they have that are private, maybe it's just them and their family and just their inner circle and the people who are around at that moment, mm-hmm. you know, that has to have so much impact.
Right. Well, and that's the kind of the role of family confidant that a lot of these cooks serve, because one, they wanted to make the life comfortable for the first family, right? It's a pressure cooker job. You're in a fishbowl in many ways. And so their role was to keep them healthy and happy. And often these foods of the president's childhood or things that they really loved would help, you know, get them through the tough times. But the interesting thing is a lot of people understood the power of the White House cook. When civil rights advocates couldn't get the ear of the president, they would go to the cook and just say, hey, could you just talk to him about this X, Y, or Z? And then the cooks, a lot of times they did. Sometimes they didn't feel it was appropriate. But, yeah, they often saw the cook as the avenue to press their civil rights agenda with the president.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like the hand that rocks the cradle.
Right.
It's the hand on the pan.
Right. Oh, I like that. I might have to steal that.
Take it and run with it, brother. You got a book tour to go on.
All right. That's cool.
Thanks so much for coming here, Dan.
All right. Thank you.
Adrian Miller, who worked in the Clinton administration, is the author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed her first families, from the Washingtons to the Obamas. You can find a recipe from that book, Daisy Bonner's Cheese Soufflé, at splendidtable.org.